What's up, family? You are tuned into Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. From KPFA Radio and the Pacifica Network, I'm your host, Kat Brooks. What's up, family? You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Our guest today is Michelle Smirnova, an associate professor of sociology and affiliate faculty of race, ethnic, and gender studies at the University of Missouri, Kansas. She's got a new book out that we're discussing today called The Prescription to Prison Pipeline. Michelle, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me. I'm very excited to be here.
Michelle, tell us a little bit about you, how you came into this work, and the impetus for telling this story in the world.
Absolutely. So I am a sociologist who studies health and social movements. And so this felt like an odd project for me to join onto, but I've been interested in sort of upstream causes of health inequality and how people resist that health inequality and what actions they take to address their health issues. And so I actually was brought onto this project by a criminologist, Dr. Jennifer Owens, who had been talking to women, incarcerated women, about cooking meth as a part of her dissertation research. And at the time, many of them were talking to her about prescription drugs and saying, you really need to pay attention to prescription drugs. And I'm talking more broadly than just opioids, but benzodiazepine, all sorts of prescription drugs that address people's psyches. And so in that process, we decided to talk to people who had become incarcerated in many cases as a result of their prescription drug use. And I term it non-medical prescription drug use rather than abuse, which I will talk about in a little bit. But in large part because as we started talking to people, and this is sort of at the beginning of what was termed the opioid epidemic, people declaring this a national health emergency, that there's this crisis with opioid abuse. But when we were talking to people, it became increasingly clear that people were using these substances the same way that many doctors would prescribe them to, and in ways to address harms and pain that didn't have another way to remedy or address outside of that use. And it was then that that use became criminalized and resulted in their incarceration that ultimately intensified harm rather than addressing the underlying harms that they were experiencing.
Right. And I think it's important to mention here, and I don't have the percentages, maybe you do, but substance use is one of the leading reasons why so many women in this country, particularly women of color, are sitting in cages.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I also don't have those number ahead in front of me, but we see how these laws change all the time. And we see how that's happened most recently with marijuana and has been the drug that has resulted in the most incarceration and now has been legalized. But the harm that has been done to those individuals, those women, those men, those people, and their families and their communities cannot be undone. And to what end? Who gets to profit now from the decriminalization or legalization and corporatization of that particular drug? So I think it offers us a really great example of how these laws change all the time, and they are often to benefit certain groups and to harm others.
Let's stay on the profit tip for a second. You have a bit about the World Health Organization declaration that freedom from pain was a universal human right. How was that seized upon by the pharmaceutical industry, and what have the consequences been?
Sure. Yeah. And I think it speaks to some of the complexity of these issues, that it's sort of stemming from real pain that people are experiencing. People are living longer than ever before. And as a result, people, especially in later life, experience all sorts of physical pain. But we can also talk about inequality and how inequality and racism produces quite a bit of physical manifestations, blood pressure, cortisol, heart disease, but also psychic pain and depression and anxiety. And so we're dealing with a lot of pain in our society. But as I argue in the book, the issue are these structural inequities and how we're not providing for elders, how we're not providing, we're not addressing these longstanding structural inequalities. We're not addressing new mothers who are often tasked with supporting children on their own. And instead, we treat it with a prescription pad. So the World Health Organization's declaration for a freedom from pain, trying to protect people and give them access to address that pain, was capitalizing on that or was trying to address that. And as you rightfully identify, these Purdue Pharma, these drug companies saw this as an opportunity for here. Here's a prescription pad. Here's a pill. We can offer this easy fix to pain. And I think it redirected our focus to, okay, there is a magic bullet that we can just prescribe someone a drug to address these issues, as opposed to dealing with these structural factors, which are, I'm not going to say more challenging, but there are many different issues that we need to address, and they uphold the system as it is. And so there's reasons why people resist that type of real, meaningful structural change.
I didn't have this question in my script, but I do want to pause here because, you know, you mentioned the sort of the boogeyman name in the conversations around the opioid epidemic, and we could talk about why that term is misleading after mm-hmm. this, but you mentioned the Purdue family. And when I think about criminalization, right, when I think about all of the people that are rotting in cages right now because they moved from, the pills, some of them to heroin or, you know, to the street economy associated with those, they're all sitting in cages. But the folks who intentionally, knowingly, actively did this to communities across the country, starting, you know, in the Appalachia, are still bazillionaires and free and going about their lives. So the contradictions in the carceral state pretty glaring when it comes to this issue.
Absolutely. I think it is incredibly, it reveals how the system is designed to work. And we talk about what is the purpose of the law, and is the purpose to prevent harm? Or is it something else? And I think seeing that disparity really sort of throws that question into stark relief. I think as an abolitionist, I don't see the solution in carceral politics, period. I think it's how do you address the harms and the people who have experienced those harms. But I think similarly, a lot of people feel it as a magic bullet, easy fix that, well, let's just throw those people in jail. So even if it were possible to punish all the people involved in the production and marketing and distribution of these drugs, does that address the harms that so many people have experienced and the harms that they experienced even before they started using those substances?
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Michelle Smirnova about her book, The Prescription to Prison Pipeline. The reaction to substance use in this country is often to blame the individual. You've alluded to it, but I'd like to give you an opportunity to go deeper and talk about the substance use being less about individuals and more about societal ills.
Absolutely. So it's the pathways to using prescription drugs are varied, as they are for all of us. you have the stories of people who are working in manual, grueling jobs. Some people who are working in warehouse floors for large corporations. And I had one respondent, one interviewee who specifically talked about how she had been prescribed prescription drugs by her employer to help her keep working. She was working 12-hour shifts, 6 days a week, and that was unsustainable. And people's bodies break down with that wear and tear. And instead of changing the policy, increasing wages, reducing hours, these sort of structural solutions, it's treated with a pill that here, you can get a pill for that. And so we hear stories like that. We hear stories of Black men who are more likely to be surveyed by police in the first place. And so they may be using prescription drugs as prescribed by a doctor, but who are more likely to be drug tested at doctor's offices or be pulled over while driving a car, and all the things, those interactions can add up and end up resulting in some infraction that results in incarceration. So I heard many stories like that. A more surprising story to some were how many mothers had experienced this route, that we don't support people who have had children, and the physical and psychological pain after giving birth to children. So there were many people who had had delivered their children through cesarean section and who had been prescribed all sorts of drugs to manage physical pain from, it's a major surgery. As well as antidepressants, anti-anxiety medications to deal with their postpartum symptoms. And I think that was really revealing about just how untenable motherhood has become in the United States, how few people have access to maternal leave, paternal leave to sort of promote gender equity, affordable childcare that schedules that align with work schedules and wages. And so, yeah, I think that was surprising to some readers that this is not the avenue that people think about, but was actually fairly common among the people I talked to.
So you're alluding to where I was going to you're making very clear what I was going to segue to next, right? The focus on individuals paves the way for criminalization. I'd like you to talk a bit about how the carceral system and that vicious cycle actually exacerbates rather than solves the problem.
Absolutely. And so again, it comes down to this question of what is the purpose of law or the enforcement of law? And if the purpose is to address harm, to prevent harm, sort of arresting people, incarcerating people on the basis of substance use is not doing anything in that vein. And especially as I talked a little bit in the beginning, that people were very varied who I spoke to. And so there were some people who found their substance use to be harming their lives in one way or another. But there were many other people who were using it in ways similar to people who use prescription drugs medically, but they had been, I feel like they were, for it, what came through in their interviews, it felt like they were borrowing the language of rehabilitation, treatment, counseling they had received, that I did something wrong. I'm a drug addict. There is something wired wrong in my brain. But the things they were describing sounded normal. And it came through particularly one man named James, who talked about how he started using prescription drugs much like his brother. And he said, I'm a chronic drug addict. But then he described how his brother used drugs the exact same way he did every single day of his life. But he was an upstanding citizen, that he was able to hold down his job. And he identified as an addict exclusively based on the fact that he was incarcerated, that he was sitting in prison. And it's, wow. So it's sort of this complexity of like, what is the meaning of that substance use? Like the carceral system, it doesn't often help. People talked about their experiences in rehab facilities, in carceral settings or outside of prison. And these often didn't feel like they were addressing their needs, but rather pathologizing who they are. That sort of once an addict, always an addict. There's something in my blood.
Right, which actually can lead people to use more, right? Like walking around in this big ball of shame is actually not beneficial to healing. And you do, a little later in the book, talk a little bit about that, how the folks that are put in these positions then give, I think you called it the privilege of professionality or something, and just sort of absorb, right, what is being told to them without question, because this is what almost they have to do, particularly people that are incarcerated, right? You want to get out, you have to say, yes, this is who I am forever.
Yes.
And ever. Amen.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think it's, we asked quite a number of questions. I was particularly interested in trust in medical institutions, and how people trust doctors or medical professions more broadly. And there, again, there would be people who had these really negative personal experiences where they felt as though their doctor didn't listen to them. They just sort of wanted to get rid of them through a prescription pad, and it felt like they destroyed their lives instead of addressing, helping them address some of these issues. And yet they continued to hold medical professions in this highly esteemed category. And sort of this, well, they're a doctor, they went to school, so clearly they know more than I do, even when that knowledge was contradictory to their lived experience, and what they were seeing firsthand. And we've seen how sort of these terms have changed over the decades in the DSM. We talk about addict, being an addict or dependent, substance dependence disorder. And the labels themselves carry this weight, especially if it's in someone's medical files or legal record. And it marks them, as Deva Pager wrote about, the power of being marked by these institutions. So we see quite a number of parallels between these carceral institutions and medical institutions that can mark people in certain ways that discredits their testimony and their lived experience. And a lot of people internalize that because our society privileges those professional voices above our own. And so we see that harm, sort of how the punishment becomes internalized by the individual who believes sort of these tales about who they are and what they're capable of.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Michelle Smirnova about her book, The Prescription to Prison Pipeline. Michelle, I want to spend a few minutes going through some terms used in the book that jumped out at me.
Sure.
What do you mean by the medicalization of pain?
Sure. So the term medicalization refers to anything that is previously not treated by medical professionals or doctors, and that currently is. So I often use the example of ADHD, and something that is increasingly medicalized. It's treated with a prescription instead of addressing sort of the structural environment. So why might it be more challenging for people to pay attention and to focus, particularly for young kids in a classroom, instead of focusing on restructuring curricular design, classrooms, the focus is on the individual and the solution is in medicine. And so we talk about the medicalization of pain. What I mean is that a lot of the sources of these pain are structural, that people don't have access to housing. People don't have access to food. They don't have wages that meet their needs, talking about affordable, accessible childcare. And so pain is produced as a result of eviction. It's produced as a result of criminalization and incarceration. It's also produced by isolation that people have from loved ones, talking about fracturing of communities, but also this feeling that I'm alone, that I need to figure this out on my own. And so what I mean by the medicalization of pain is how these issues are treated with a prescription pad, that we can address the physical pain that you incurred on the job or through your cesarean section with this pad, rather than providing time off so that you can properly heal, and providing you with the support you need so that you don't feel alone and desperate. So that's a little bit of the way that I talk about the medicalization of pain in the book.
There's another term in the book, injuries of inequality.
Yes. So this is a term from Celeste Watkin Hayes. And she talked about this quite a bit in her research. She conducted research with women who were diagnosed with HIV. And she found counterintuitively that these women started to receive the support that they needed only after they had been diagnosed with HIV, that this is when all these support networks came to help them with their unmet needs. And so she refers to these injuries of inequality of the unmet needs they've had their entire lives, and their is in our country, have not been provided with the resources or support. And it's only until they have experienced this great harm that it's finally recognized that they need help in these different forms. And so she talks about sort of this intersectionality of the injuries of racism and sexism and classism, and how all of these things intersect and interlock in ways that exacerbate the pain that people and the injuries that people experience structurally and socially.
At the beginning of our interview, you used the word health inequality a few times. Wonder if you'd say a bit more about that. But then the flip side of that, what does health equity actually mean materially and in practice?
It's a good question. I think when I talk about health inequality, some of the things that I mentioned about people who have differential access to safe and healthy housing and green spaces and freedom from stress and quality of life. And so we see how these manifest in can see most recently in different rates of COVID exposure, different rates of people who contracted HIV and who died from HIV. I should repeat that. So we can see how that manifests in differential rates of COVID and people who contracted COVID and people who died from COVID. But when we talk about health equity, we can think about this sort of the right to life, liberty, and pursuit of justice, that who has the right to live and what quality of life do people have to live? And we know that that is incredibly stratified in this country as well as in other parts of the world. And we can quantify that in terms of how long people live. But health equity, I think, is broader than that in terms of focusing on quality of life. And so that's why I talk about in the book addressing these broader structures that may seem unrelated to substance use. But this is talking about abolition, talking about housing for all, talking about healthcare for all, talking about having wages and support, other sort of supports for people to live the type of life they want to live. And so I think health equity is, it extends much further than the healthcare industry itself, because it is dealing with quality of life, and how we can promote that by creating a society in which everyone can live a good life.
I have a couple more terms, but I want to pivot here just for a second to talk about data. Mm-hmm. And the ways in which we're just not making data-driven decisions when it comes to public safety, right? So all of the, like, you're not, I say often, like, these aren't radical Kat Brooks's ideas, right? That more police doesn't equal less crime. I didn't, you know, come up with the fact that longer incarceration sentences do not make safer communities. Same with the things that you're talking about here. But that is not what we see being utilized to make decisions about incarceration, medicalization, any of those things. And I just wonder if you would reflect on that for a moment, right? The desire to maintain the status quo and to be able to continue to profit off of the oppression and repression of the people, and how much that's a driving force of the realities our people live in every day.
Absolutely. Absolutely. I think you raise a really important point about how a lot of these policies are not driven by the data. And we see that by the fact that people who are released from prison are much more likely to overdose, much more likely to die by overdose than people who are not. Communities that see much higher rates of policing of substance use also have higher rates of overdose. And so, again, if we ask the question of what is the harm that the law is seeking to prevent or address, that these approaches are clearly intensifying the harm, if we think of overdose as one of the greatest harms to come from substance use. So clearly these approaches are not addressing those just numerically. But we think even more broadly of how many people participate in these treatment programs that return time and again, that it's anecdotal, but a lot of people talk about, well, of course, rehab doesn't work the first time or the second time or however many times. And instead of reconsidering, well, maybe this approach isn't effective, maybe we should reconsider this approach, it's sort of blaming the individual, that it sort of expected this harm that they're going to experience, the same way that people expect harm to happen in prison. That, well, of course, they're in prison. They deserve that harm. And it bears this question of, well, what is the punishment that you are seeking, or what are you seeking to accomplish by this? And it really lays bare what people desire or believe in ugly ways.
You're listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks, in conversation with Michelle Smirnova about her book, The Prescription of Prison Pipeline. My listeners know that when I was 10, 8, 9, somewhere in there, my father was incarcerated for substance use. And I talk a lot about the ways in which that impacted my life, still does, but like in really not helpful ways. The decision to use the carceral state to respond to substance abuse does not just harm the individual, it can and often does have generational implications. Can you talk about the ways in which the violence of this response impacts families and future generations and connect that to health?
Absolutely. Absolutely. And yeah, I mean, I think there are many white people in particular who feel very removed from the carceral system. It doesn't feel like something that it impacts them. But so many people are impacted as a society. But what you're discussing about how many people have a parent or a sibling or a family member who is incarcerated, and how that is incredibly patterned by race and class, and how that decimates communities. I can repeat that. So that the number of people who have a parent or a sibling or a family member who have been incarcerated is incredibly patterned by race, and that decimates communities. And so when we talk about the reverberating effects, we can talk about that sort of at the level that you experienced about, first of all, growing up without a dad, or growing up without having a dad at home with you. And then to be told by all these institutions, to be told by society that your dad is a bad person, and that that you're better off without having him in your home. And for entire communities to be told that they're better off without having, that there's all these bad people amongst them. And these are the people, our loved ones. And the harm, the psychological harm that that has, that we all know that people, that children benefit from having more loved ones to care from them, for people to be able to go to talk to and to love. We also can talk about the financial element about driving people into poverty when you remove wage earners from families and from communities. And so we can talk about all the pain that is experienced at this level of not having this person removed from your family, having them removed from your neighborhood and your community, but simultaneously the convincing that is done that it's for the best, that that is a bad person. And so it's trying to permanently remove that person from your life, that if they do get out, when they do get out, that you see them differently because that's the way you're told to see them differently. And again, we don't trust our own experiences of, I see before my eyes someone who wants to be a part of my life, someone who wants to, who loves me and cares for me, but we may question that or second guess that because we're told this person has this legal history, and therefore that is defining of who they are as a person. And yeah, that harms people's health, psychological, financial, physical, and produces that health inequity.
And here again is an example of not using data-driven decision-making, because they do this, they say, in the name of public safety, right? We have to incarcerate these people who are using these substances because they're a danger to society. But one of the greatest indicators of a safe community, right, is a full family, as you pointed out earlier. However that family is constructed, having those family members inside of the home. Michelle Spranova, we're in a particular political moment, right, where we are dealing with the white lash to the defund movement. Not that anyone was defunded anywhere, but there was this national conversation, right, that like shook the status quo to the point that they there was an active campaign to lie about the impacts of defund because it made sense to people. Talk about this book and this conversation inside of this political climate, where the answer, again, you know, I feel like we've gone back, you know, to the 1980s and the response to the crack cocaine epidemic, to just we're just going to incarcerate our way to this illusion anyway of safety.
Absolutely. Yeah. No, I think there's a misunderstanding, this white lash to defunding rhetoric. There's a misunderstanding that these arguments are about the underfunding of our communities. And I think if you talk to people about, well, what do we need? That people, the rent is too damn high. That people recognize that their rent is going up, that their groceries are going up, that gas is going up, that the costs of surviving are going up, and it is untenable. And yet they feel alone in that. They feel as well, I guess I need to find a higher paying job, or I need to get another job, or I need to do something personally to make ends meet, to make it work. And instead, we're not paying attention to the way these things are structurally produced, and who gets subsidies and support and who doesn't, what gets constructed as welfare and what doesn't. Talk about Social Security benefits is not understood as a welfare benefit, although it is, and it is something to support older folks. But again, it sort of distracts this, the sort of resistance against it is this, it's the misunderstanding that this is calling for supporting communities, supporting all communities, but to particularly those communities that have been not provided with those resources historically and contemporaneously. Basic things that people need to live. People need housing. They need healthcare. They need school, quality school. They need childcare. They need all of these things. And these are things that if you talk to most folks, I think they would agree that, of course, everyone should have access to these things. And they might be surprised to learn that most people don't have those things, and they need those things to survive. And it's in the same context of the one thing that is funded in their neighborhood is the police. And the police are there all the time. And all the research finds that there are the same levels of illegal activity in white affluent communities as in poor communities of color. And yet there is a very disparate police presence. And so, of course, if you're there and you're pulling over more people, you're going to find something at a much higher rate, even though it's happening at the same rate everywhere else. And it also raises the question of what are those laws that are being enforced in the first place? I'm sure all of us have committed the crime of jaywalking, of walking outside of a crosswalk, but who's likely to be stopped by a police officer for doing it? Who's likely to have that on their record? And these things add up. And so I think, again, it's this this anger towards certain groups or turning a blind eye that it doesn't feel like it directly impacts me. So I don't need to pay attention to that.
Michelle Sprinova, what is your hope for this book in the world?
My hope for the book in the world is to draw attention to the many people who are just trying to get by. My hope for the book is that people will read it and they might come into it with this assumption that people, especially people who are incarcerated for substance use, that they're doing it harmfully. And that this, by locking them up, we're somehow addressing it in some way. And my hope is that when they read the stories of the people in this book, that they come to understand that those people are just like them. And that those people have, maybe they're not like them in that they've experienced many more harms and much greater pain, but they're just trying to survive in a system that doesn't provide them with the support network, that doesn't provide them with the services or infrastructure that they need. And the one thing that they do provide them with is a prescription pad. And who is likely to then be criminalized for that substance use? And so I think it's part of a broader, it's in conversation with a lot of research on substance use more broadly. And again, this is a story that we know since the 1980s, well before then. This country has a history of using drug policies to criminalize and incarcerate people of color, and especially when they are perceived as an economic or social threat to the white order. And so prescription drugs, I think, are just the most recent iteration of that. And I think we need to really ask ourselves, is is the problem the drugs, or is the problem these underlying harms that are being left unaddressed?
Michelle Spranova, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you so much. I really appreciated this. And I love your work. And I hope your listeners enjoyed the book.
Thank you so much. Fam Bam, you've been listening to Law and Disorder. I'm your host, Kat Brooks. Our guest today has been Michelle Spranova. We've been in conversation about her book, The Prescription to Prison Pipeline. You've been listening to Law and Disorder, a podcast where we expose the cracks in our system, agitate for resistance, and collectively build a new world in which all of us can thrive. That's it for this episode, family. You can find more information about topics and guests in this episode's show notes. Law and Disorder is produced at KPFA. That's listener-supported radio on the Pacifica Network. The show is produced by Jesse Strauss and hosted by me, Kat Brooks. Our theme music was composed by Steve Raskin of Fort Knox 5. If you like what you heard, please follow us on social media at Law and Dis, that's D-I-S, and subscribe wherever you listen to podcasts. Feel free to holler at us about something you heard or send us a show idea at lawanddisorder@kpfa.org. You can also find our content live at 8 a.m. weekdays on KPFA. That's 94.1 FM in the Bay Area. Our show and all of KPFA's programs are funded exclusively by you, the listener. And if you're in a position to support us, please donate today at kpfa.org. Take care of yourself and take care of each other. We all we got, fam.